Like to thank everyone for coming this evening. The title of this evening's talk is Who is God? From Vedic Authority. Vedas are the scriptures of India. And in the Vedas you get more information about God than you get from any other source on the planet. And so therefore the information that we're going to transmit to you today is information that you cannot get anywhere else. Based on the teachings of A.C. Bhakti Vedanta, again you see that word Veda there, Bhakti Vedanta, Anta means end. The Vedas themselves, as scriptural body, are vast and voluminous. There are more Vedas than you could even read in one lifetime, what to speak of, absorb them and realize them. But Anta means the end or the goal of the Vedas. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Vedas cha sarve aham eva vedo, Vedanta krit veda, vid eva chaham. I am the goal of the Vedas. And bhakti refers to devotion. So Bhakti Vedanta is a title referring to someone who has realized the goal of the Vedas through loving devotional service. In other words, they've realized who is God, and from such a person we learn who is God. We all know there's a God. Almost every society in the world, whether it's primitive or advanced, there's some concept of a supreme being. If someone doesn't recognize that they're not in control, rather they're being controlled by higher forces, they're just not very conscious at all. Even the most beginning or most nascent or primordial of consciousnesses has to acknowledge that we're being controlled by some higher authority. So pretty much it's universal, the idea that there is some controller out there. There is a God, but who that person is, who's the supreme controller, that information you're only going to get to this extent in the Vedic literatures. For instance, we all know there's a president. We know some basic things about him. He lives in the White House. His license plate on his car says U.S. 1. He has an Air Force 1 plane. He's the commander-in-chief of everyone. So we know a few general facts about the position of president. But who the person is who is the president, that's the issue here. We all know there's a God, but who is he? What is his name? What is his address? What does he look like? Who are his best friends? What are his pastimes? And what are his preferences? That you get from Vedic education. These images are probably a little bit too small for you to read from the distance that you're at. But it talks about the two types of education. And on the right hand, you have what's called material education, which pertains to the body, how to keep body and soul together. Now, the animals are doing that without going to a big university. The ants are keeping body, soul together. They're getting little crumbs of food on the floor and subsisting. The elephant is getting 500 kgs a day of food, and he doesn't have a university degree. So maybe big multi-million dollar universities with elaborate tuition is a little bit redundant in order to achieve the same thing that the ant and the elephant are getting without that kind of educational background. Of course, we polish up the animal propensities of eating, sleeping, and mating, defending. We eat at restaurants. We sleep in a comfortable water bed. We defend with atomic missiles. But basically, we're still just pursuing the animal activities. And so mundane education has limited value, whereas on the left-hand side you see spiritual education, which gives us a happiness for which we are looking, and it solves our deepest disquietude about mortality. And its branches here, we have basically seven problems that face us. And unless we solve these problems in the human form of life, we're not really educated to the highest degree that we could be. By your PhD at MIT, have you solved the problems of birth, death, disease, and old age? By your PhD at MIT or Stanford, have you solved the problems of the threefold miseries of life? Miseries arising from nature, miseries arising from other living beings, and miseries arising from our own bodies and mind. Does modern, mundane education solve any of these seven problems of life? Birth, death, disease, old age, miseries due to nature like tidal waves, hurricanes, earthquakes, miseries due to other living beings. If you're over there in Iraq, you know what I'm talking about. If you're an American soldier, there's Iraqis trying to kill you. If you're an Iraqi, there's American soldiers maybe trying to kill you. And miseries due to the body and mind, physical and mental diseases. So spiritual education addresses itself to these problems, and unless we solve these problems, cannot be said to be truly an educated person. Who is God? It's the question that people have asked since day one. And there are two basic schools of thought. And in India, these two sides have debated back and forth, back and forth, back and forth for centuries and centuries. One believed that God is an impersonal light or an energy, and the other, of which we are subscribers, believes that God is a supreme person, not an impersonal force or energy. And there's ways to deduct that very easily. You take a company like Microsoft, doesn't happen by accident. It's not an impersonal organization. It's a multinational company with branches all over the world. Is that all happening due to some impersonal force behind it? Or would we rather expect and anticipate and even count and bet on a person being behind Microsoft? And if you've betted on the latter, hey, you won. His name is Bill Gates. So behind this cosmic manifestation, is there a personal or is there an impersonal force? Let's look at just modern government. And here you have different levels here. You have the country level, you have the state level, you have the county level, you have the city level. And what are some of the things that we need in order to run even a small little burg like Spanish Fork? Well, we need finances, we need home affairs, we've got some emergency system, emergency response system, we've got a security system, we've got a business branch, we've got a tax branch, we've got an assessor's office, we've got an auditor's office, we've got the police force. In Spanish Fork, which is a town of maybe 20,000 people, I dare say they hire maybe up to 100 people just to keep this little burg running. So in the universe, then, are we to assume that it's all just going on without any departmentalization or any personalities in charge? Look at the similarities between the way the universe is run and the way that a secular government is run. Look at all the parallels here. You've got your home department, your home ministry, which is in charge of law and order. And in the universe, you have the law of karma, the universal law of karma, which enforces law and order. What goes around comes around. You've got your defense and your finance ministry, and so you have your army and your police chief, your police force. And in the universe, you've also got a defense mechanism. You've got the ozone layer, you've got your own immune system. Animals, every single animal has something that protects it, whether it's able to run faster, or whether it's got a shell, or whether it can camouflage itself. Every single creature in the universe has some particular means of defense. And is that happening impersonally or accidentally? Power supply, you've got electricity in the secular state. And in the universe, you've got sun, moon, wind, water. And in fact, we're hoping to convert from fossil fuels to solar fuel, wind fuel, take advantage of the energy. We're not creating energy, we're just harnessing energy that's already put there by an impersonal force, by accident, or by a person. Nobody would be so foolish to think that the energy which comes to us through this chandelier is coming impersonally or accidentally. You trace it back, you'll trace it back to a powerhouse that someone designed and someone built, and in that powerhouse there'll be a caretaker, making sure that the current is always running. Personality. Health ministry. You got your health care, your medicine. And in the Vedic literatures, there's an elaborate system called Ayurveda for maintaining ideal health. Did you also know that 2,500 years ago in the Ayurvedic system, there were 125 different surgical instruments? There was anesthesia. Some of the surgical instruments were sharp enough to divide the tip of a hair into 100 parts. And brain surgery was a capability when and where it was needed as well. And education, you have all your public schools on the elementary and secondary and primary level. Similarly, you have the Vedic literatures. Veda actually means knowledge. The Vedas, as vast as they are, cover all areas of mundane knowledge, and they also cover the meaning of God as well. Food supply, we have food and water. We go to the grocery store, but where does actually the food and water come from? It comes from rainfall that God supplies. The bread, you know, it may be, what are some of the mills around? It might be Lehigh Mills bread, or there's one kind that we buy, I forget, Aspen Mills bread. It may have various labels on it, but the bread is actually coming from the grains that are coming from the rainfall that is supplied by something impersonal or someone personal. And we could go on and on and on, but obviously this is a very, very well-run universe. And if we assume quid pro quo that our secular governments are run by persons, then how do we make the leap and then talk about the absolute truth, the person who created and who is in charge of all this, as being someone impersonal? It's only logical to understand that behind all of this, there is a supreme personality of Godhead. He may have many different names, but the highest nomenclature is Krishna. Krishna means all attractive, and we'll talk more about that. But the absolute truth has his impersonal feature, there's no doubt about that. But he also has a localized feature, which is in the heart of each and every living being. And then there is the supreme personality of Godhead, his individual presence in his own spiritual abode, far from this material world. When we refer to God being everything, we're referring to the Brahma Jyoti, the Brahman. If you took a world religions class, they've taught you about the Brahman. The Brahman is the effulgence from God. He's so powerful, he emits a radiance. Just like the sun, the radiance of the sun is the sunshine. So the sunshine is one aspect of the sun, but it's not the be-all and end-all. When we talk about God being everything, we're talking about the Brahman aspect of the Lord. When we talk about God being everywhere, we're talking about that expansion of the Lord, which is in the heart, or who is in the heart of every living being. This is called Paramatma. Atma is a Sanskrit word for soul, and Param means oversoul or super soul. Each one of us is an individual soul in our individual bodies. We're aware of the individual pains and pleasures in our particular body. But accompanying the individual soul is the supreme soul, or the Paramatma, and he's aware of the pains and pleasures in each and every body throughout the entire universe. Not only human beings, but llamas and parrots and ants and elephants. That's called the localized aspect of the Lord. And then the supreme aspect of the Lord is called Bhagavan. That's the supreme personality of Godhead. He's everywhere present in each and every atom and in everyone's heart in this material world, just like the sun is present everywhere through its particles. But the sun globe itself is also separate and distinct, and it has its own situation in the sky. So God is at one and the same time everywhere present, and he also preserves his own individual personality in the spiritual world. And that supreme aspect of the Lord is called Bhagavan. Once again, the sun has three aspects, the sunshine, the sun globe, and then there is a presiding deity, according to our Vedic information, who lives in the sun planet, and his name is Vivashwan. So if you know the sunshine, you don't necessarily know the globe, you don't know the sun god. If you know the sun globe, you know the sunshine, but you don't necessarily know the sun god. However, if you're aware of the sun god, then you're automatically aware, included within that knowledge is the knowledge of the sun globe and the sunshine. So included within the knowledge of God as Bhagavan, the supreme person, is the knowledge of the Lord within the heart, call him the Holy Ghost or the Holy Spirit or whatever you like, as well as the impersonal aspect of the Lord, which is called Brahman. All this is described in the Bhagavad Gita, which Krishna personally spoke 5,100 years ago when he personally came to the planet. We have Bhagavad Gita teachings every evening at 6 o'clock. You'll see the Gita's there, and there's a lot more stacked behind the screen. So as many people come in the evenings to study Bhagavad Gita's, we've got copies of that for you. Gita means song, translated from the Sanskrit, and Bhagavat means God. If you're reading the Bhagavad Gita to get the most out of it, to wring truth from the Bhagavad Gita, the following requirements should be observed. It's a real historical dialogue between Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and Arjuna, Kurukshetra, the battlefield on which it took place, and all the characters like Arjuna, Bhima, and others, they're all real. One should not twist this truth and bring out some allegorical meaning. That's why our edition of the Bhagavad Gita is called the Bhagavad Gita as it is, not as some people would like it or imagine it to be. It should be read and understood as it is coming in disciplic succession. See, the most recent member of the disciplic succession is Srila Prabhupada. And if you're seated in a position, you can see that hanging on the wall. See on the left-hand side of the alcove? I think Justin is probably the last person that can see it, and he might get a crick in his neck looking. You see the disciplic succession. his guru and his guru and his guru, going all the way back to Lord Brahma, the creator of the universe, and then Lord Krishna in the upper left-hand side. The knowledge, perfect knowledge, begins with God, and it is passed down through an unbroken chain of disciplic succession. Third, Krishna is the goal of the Gita. Many editions, and there are over 1,000 editions of the Bhagavad Gita. So this isn't just a small point I'm making. The 999 translations and commentaries of the Bhagavad Gita in the English language mislead you in one, if not more, of these ways. And so to read the real Bhagavad Gita as it is, these are the recommended observances. Many editions of the Gita have brushed aside Krishna and Arjuna and carry self-motivated interpretations. Fourth, Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He's not ordinary or even an extraordinary person. Bhagavad Gita should be heard in the spirit of devotion like Arjuna. Fifth, Bhagavad Gita is spoken by the Absolute Person and it is absolute knowledge. It's good in all time, all place, all circumstances. It's never outdated. It's not like relative knowledge, which scientists with imperfect senses spin out and then completely change every 5 or 10 years. I guarantee you that the textbooks that you're studying in college right now will be completely outmoded 5 or 6 years from now. And the textbooks that I studied in college have been outmoded by decades and decades and decades. And yet what Krishna spoke originally 120 million years ago is still just as fresh and relevant now as it was then. And sixth, the Bhagavad Gita is a scientific presentation of philosophy and informs us what is our constitutional position, Shadharma. It's given, it's verifiable, and it's also confirmed. Each person, each practitioner of the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita, pratyaksavagamam dharmam, can experience for themselves that God is a person and not something impersonal. Seventh, the word of the Lord is as good as the Lord. Someone may lament, well, how am I going to become Krishna conscious if Krishna is not physically present before us? But Krishna says, vani and vapu. The physical presence and the words are exactly the same. They have the same potency. The reason that Krishna spoke Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna and made sure it was heard and it was transcribed and passed down is that so we would get the same benefit, the same potency that Arjuna got hearing directly from Krishna in his presence. So one should receive this knowledge in a very respectful mood with the desire to perfect one's life and not for any material gains. Even though the Lord is not personally present before us, His instructions are no less potent. And there is a significant reason why the Gita is spoken on a battlefield. Life is also a struggle. Every day is a battle of sorts. And the Bhagavad Gita is for those who want to tackle the battle of life and deliver themselves from ignorance and attain ultimate perfection. Now, how do we understand it? Ultimately, it's stated in the fourth chapter, Tadvidi pranipatena paripashnena seve upadekshanti te gyanam gyaninas tadvadarshana. Just try to learn the truth by approaching a spiritual master, inquire from him submissively and render service unto him. The self-realized soul can impart knowledge unto you because he has seen the truth. Becoming God consciousness is not just an academic exercise. It's a transformation of consciousness. So unless someone has already undergone that transformation of consciousness, you will not pick it up. You will not imbibe it. You have to learn not just from what one speaks, but you're going to learn from what your teacher is. Not just by precept, but by example. So it's very, very important to associate with a realized soul. Many people try to read the Bhagavad Gita and understand it on their own. In fact, I talk to a lot of people from India, and they claim to know the Bhagavad Gita. Yes, yes, I know the Bhagavad Gita. What's your favorite verse? Tell me if I'm wrong. My favorite verse is where Krishna tells you to do whatever you want to do. Have you heard that before? After Krishna's explained everything, given all recommendations, fully exposed himself as a personality, then finally, acknowledging the free agency of the living being, he says to Arjuna, just, okay, now you've been informed, make your decision, do what you want to do. And there are people who will skip over all the instructions and they'll say their favorite verses. They'll say the whole meaning of the Bhagavad Gita is do whatever you want to do, which basically skips over 699 verses of the Bhagavad Gita and the whole point of the Bhagavad Gita itself. So it's not meant to be taken in that way. There are five truths that the Gita deals with. One is Ishvara, the supreme controller of God. Two is the Jiva, the living entity. We talked about the Atma and then the Paramatma. Three is material nature, this material nature which has a beginning, a middle, an end, which is never stable from one minute to another. Our bodies are made from material nature, and our bodies are constantly in flux. The body you have today is not exactly the same body you had yesterday. Tomorrow's body will be slightly different again. Over the course of every 7 to 10 years, all the cells of your body will have changed and been replaced by new ones. So there are no two moments, in fact, when your body is the same. That's because your body is part of material nature. But you're eternally the same because you're not material. You're part of spiritual nature. And then eternal time is a fourth topic in the Bhagavad Gita. And finally, karma, or action and reaction. Actions motivated by time. And there are three levels of realization. Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana. It's compared to a lady in India, the marriages used to be arranged. And the bride would often not have ever met the husband, or and vice versa, when she came to his house. That was the case maybe, 75, 100 years ago and further back. So there's a lot of hesitancy, there's a lot of nervousness, there's no intimacy there whatsoever. And we find that by doing the household chores and work and so on and so forth, there becomes a certain friendship that is developed, a certain easy rapport, a certain easy relationship. There's less guardedness and there's more trust there. And that's compared to Abhideya, the process of awakening an intimate relationship. And then after some time, when they're comfortable with each other, they'll get together with the idea of producing a child, when there's a certain level of intimacy. And then that child signals the third mature level of relationship, which is called prayojana, the mature result, where love comes. People talk about love at first sight. There is no such thing as love at first sight. There's lust at first sight. There's arousal at first sight. There's infatuation at first sight. But Mark Twain said you can only know love after 25 years of marriage. Love comes after there's a commitment and after there's marriage. But these are the preliminary stages. Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana. Here in the 400 Krishna temples all over the world, we rise early in the morning. We don't always feel like rising early in the morning, but we do it. Just like the new wife, she doesn't always feel like cooking for this guy she doesn't know, but she does it. Even if it's mechanical, she does it. And in the course of doing it, she begins to feel better and better and more comfortable and find more and more meaning in it. Similarly, it's not always easy to get up early in the morning and chant the names of God. But the more that you do it, even if you have to force it, the more comfortable, the more trust in God, the more knowledge of God that you get. And eventually, nothing on earth can keep you out of bed in the morning. You jump up and you look eagerly forward to coming and getting the darshan of the Lord. That means that your relationship with God is stirring. It's reviving. And then when you hear the name Krishna and your hair stands on end, when you chant Krishna and your whole body erupts in goosebumps, when you chant Krishna and tears flow from your eyes like torrents of rain, when you chant Krishna and a moment's separation from Krishna seems like 12 years or more, that's prayojana. That's the full-fledged mature fruit of love of God. But it starts through the mechanical processes. What is God? Who is God? He's the Supreme Personality of God. He's the Supreme Creator, Supreme Controller, Supreme Enjoyer. He's the original source of everything. And this is important. He has no other source. Some people think they're so clever by asking, well, if God created everything, then who created God? But that's the definition of God. God created everything. Nobody created God. God controls everything. Nobody controls God. God dominates everything. No one dominates God. God is the source of everything, but there's nothing that's the source of God. Sarva karana karanam, the cause of all causes. And there are many names for Him, but the highest appellation is Krishna. These are a quote from the Bhagavad Gita, Aham Sarvasya Prabhavo. I am the source, Krishna declares, of all spiritual and material worlds. Everything emanates from Me. And what have we got here? Here He is as Mahavishnu, and another verse, Under my will, this material manifestation is created and unmanifested and manifested again and again. A person, these are going pretty fast now. I am the source, I am the only object and source of sacrifice. Those who do not recognize my true transcendental nature fall down. Aham hi sarva yajnam bhuktum cha prabhureva cha. As the creator of everything, God's natural position is as the enjoyer. We make a mistake if we think of ourselves as the enjoyer. We make a mistake if we think that God has put everything here for us to enjoy. He says the opposite in the Bhagavad Gita. Bhoktaram yagatapasham. I am the enjoyer. Our enjoyment comes by rendering pleasure to the Lord, not by trying to take or enjoy independently. Just like the example of the finger. Finger cannot enjoy. Nirmala's brought some nice milkshake today for the feast. She makes a wonderful milkshake. But the procedure for enjoying the milkshake, if the hand has the milkshake, the hand can say, I got the milkshake. I got it first. I got it before the knee. I got it before the ankle. I got it before the ear. I got it before the nose. I got it. I'm not going to give it up. I got it. I'm going to enjoy it. Isn't that kind of like us? You know, the most two common, often used words are I and mine. So I got it, it's mine, I'm going to enjoy it, right? But if the hand persists in that attitude, it's not going to enjoy it. Because the hand doesn't have the capability of enjoying the milkshake. It has to relinquish the milkshake to the stomach. It has to give it up. And when the milkshake goes into the stomach, then not only the hand, but all the other parts of the body will enjoy it. So when we strive to please God, that is in our ultimate best interest. That is how we feel pleasure in this world. And any efforts to the contrary are just going to result in misery. And as the source of everything, Lord Brahma, the creator of the universe, said, Krishna is known as Govinda. He has an eternal, blissful, spiritual body. He's the origin of all. He has no other origin. And he is the prime cause of all causes. One interesting feature about the body of Krishna is that the senses are what we call non-differentiated. A material body such as the body we have, you can only taste and speak with the tongue. You can only smell with the nose. You can only hear with the ears. You can only touch with the fingers. But Krishna is not a spirit inside of a material body. He's Advaitam. That means he's all-powerful. He's spirit through and through. So his senses are non-differentiated. That means he can taste with his ears. He can speak with his nose. He can see with his chin. Every single sense is unlimitedly capable. It's not distinguished or differentiated. Mata paratananyanya. In answer to the question, is the personal or the impersonal higher? Krishna is standing face to face before Arjuna and he's saying, Mata parataram nanyat. Mata, just like English, me. Parataram, para, para means higher. So Krishna is saying to Arjuna, ma, mata, me, parataram, nanyat. I think you get the idea. Right? Me, higher, nanyat. Nothing is higher than the personal feature of Krishna. There is nothing superior to me. Everything rests upon me as pearls are strung on a thread. Now, Krishna means all attractive, and as such, to be all attractive, you have to possess six opulences in full. Aishwarya samagrasya viryasya yasasasya jnanam vairagya chapi sanam bhagami tingana. Who possesses all riches, all strength, all power, all wisdom, all beauty, and all renunciation, that person is Krishna or God. Once I was in Los Angeles, my wife and I spent about 10 years in the LA temple. And we'd go to Westwood on Saturday nights chanting Hare Krishna. And between the chanting, I would often step forward and speak to the crowd, such as it was. One day after I'd given my little talk, a Christian, a very, very fervent, born-again Christian came up. And he was quite large, quite strong, and he was quite agitated at my presenting Krishna as God. And he just, like, he was just like, I could feel the little spittle coming in my face and everything. And he says, Krishna is not God. And I said, okay, calm down. I'm not going to get into a my God, your God type of a confrontation with you. But just bear with me here for 5 minutes. Just bear with me here. I said, is God, according to the information that you have, is God all-powerful? He said, yes, of course. I said, well, Krishna means six things, and one of them is all-powerful. So, Krishna means all-powerful. I said to him, is God, as according to the evidence that you have from your scripture, is he omniscient? He said, of course, he's omniscient. Well, Krishna means omniscient. I said, has he created everything, and therefore does he own everything? He said, yes, he does. Well, the third meaning of Krishna is the most wealthy. I said, is God, according to your information, the most famous person? Is there anyone that's not heard of God? Even atheists. God doesn't exist. I don't believe in God. There is no God. Well, he just said God three times. So he's also spreading the fame of God in his own way. I said, is God the most famous? He said, yes. So that's a fourth meaning of Krishna. And I said, is God the most beautiful? Of course, if anyone's more beautiful than God, then he's not the supreme. So he has to be, as well as those other things, the most beautiful. He said, yeah, if God is okay, he's the most beautiful. And I said, is he the most humble as well? Ourselves, if we get a little strength in the gym, or good bank balance, or some fame, we get all swell-headed and puffed up about it, and we strut out and, you know, wonder if everyone's noticing me. God has all strength, all wealth, all beauty, all fame, and at the same time, he's unlimitedly humble. He's not in the least bit swell-headed about it. So I said, would God, according to the information that you have, be unlimitedly detached and humble? He said, yes. Okay, then I said, we can agree on one thing. We don't agree that God is Krishna. But we do agree that Krishna is God. We don't agree that Krishna is God, but we do agree that God is Krishna. He just agreed that God is all wealthy, all strength, all famous, all knowledgeable, and all humble. And he said, yeah, okay. Krishna is not God, but God is Krishna. I said, okay, let's shake hands, pat each other on the back, and each one go happily on their own way. So 5,000 years ago, the Lord was here. People say, well, how can God come here? Isn't he otherworldly? Hey, he created this world, and he winds it up, and you're going to tell me that he has no right to be here? It's like if you build a house, you buy the land, you build a house, and then someone says, well, you have no right to live in it. Well, if anyone has a right to live in it, you have a right to live in it. Not that God wants to come here. He has a far better world, where everything's eternal, full of bliss and knowledge. But if he wants to come here on a mission of mercy to canvass fallen conditioned souls and beckon them back home, back to the eternal world, there certainly isn't anyone that can prohibit him. So he was here 5,000 years ago, and by way of enchanting us and luring us back to the spiritual world, he exhibited all the opulences of the spiritual world, which include riches. When Krishna was on the planet, in his city of Dwarka, he built 16,000 palaces. 16,000 palaces he built in Dwarka. And the pillars are still there. Am I right, Dhirubhai? The pillars are still there offshore, the 16,000 palaces that Krishna built. All strength. See this picture here? And this picture here? When he had only been 7 years into his manifested earthly pastimes, Indra, who in that picture there you see riding on the elephant, he's the lord of rain, he caused a devastating rainfall to fall onto Vrindavan, the village where Krishna was exhibiting his pastimes. In fact, Indra invoked clouds which are only invoked once in the history of the universe. These clouds, Shambhataka cloud, are reserved only for the annihilation of the universe. Otherwise, you don't see these clouds even in a normal summer rain shower. You don't see them even in a tsunami. You don't normally see them. They're only usually invoked one time when it's time to devastate the universe. But Indra invoked them to test Krishna's power. And Krishna responded to the rain, which was coming like pillars, by lifting a mountain, holding it aloof with the little finger of his left hand for 7 days. For 7 days. Now, is there anyone that can do that? I don't care how much creatine you take. You might be able to lift a Volkswagen for 2 seconds. with using all of your strength, you know, and having your veins pop out. But lift a mountain effortlessly with the little finger of your left hand and hold it for 7 days, giving shelter to the beleaguered inhabitants of Vrindavan. Fame, of course, Krishna is famous all over the world. Everyone's heard Hare Krishna. Beauty, when you think about God, He'd never be old. He's all powerful, and time and matter have no ability to cause Him to age, should He not desire so. I don't know who that fellow is on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, but he's not God. All knowledge. Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita 5,100 years ago, 700 verses divided into 18 chapters. He spoke it just before a great war took place. After Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita, hostilities were engaged, and in the next 18 days, 6.5 million soldiers were killed. Very stressful situation, right on the eve of a battle. Hard to think straight. Krishna was so cool and calm, because after all he's God, so nothing ruffles him. He spoke just extempore, the 700 verses of the Bhagavad Gita, to qualify Arjuna to do his duty. He spoke it in a half an hour, just off the top of his head. And 5,000 years ago, the biggest scholars are trying to study it at Oxford and Cambridge. And because they're not observing the four requisites, the seven requisites, they don't even understand a word. They don't have a bona fide guru in disciplic succession. They don't take Krishna as a historical personality, because they ignore those cautions that we gave in the beginning. The biggest scholars, they don't understand even word one of the Bhagavad Gita. And all humility. One time, Krishna's devotee Maharaj Yudhisthira was performing a Rajasuya sacrifice. Whoever successfully performs a Rajasuya sacrifice becomes the accepted and acknowledged king of the world. And kings from all over the globe at that time came to what is present-day Delhi, and they paid tribute to Yudhisthira. They had a choice. They could either fight or pay tribute. They could either oppose him, in which case Yudhisthira would send out an army, and they decide by hostilities whether Yudhisthira was king or not, or they would just pay tribute. There was no fight. Well, thousands and thousands of kings all over the world acknowledged Yudhisthira's righteousness and morality and ability to rule them, and they all converged in Delhi with all of their retainers, all of their bodyguards. Millions and millions of members of the royal order came to Delhi to pay tribute to Yudhisthira. So there needed to be a lot of logistics, a lot of organization to receive all those guests. And in Vedic culture, if any of you are Westerners and you've ever been to the home of an Indian friend, you know how important hospitality is, the importance on hospitality. So all these kings had to be received very nicely, and the duties were divided up. Sahadev took charge of taking, giving cows in charity as gifts to all the visitors, because cows were the main means of wealth in those days. Nakula took charge of stabling and brushing down and feeding all of their horses. Bhima took charge of the kitchen so that all the guests and visitors would be well fed. Draupadi, the lady of the house, she took charge of the finances. She was the one with her little PD, what do they call it? PD machine or pocket calculator. And she took all the tribute, all the gold and jewels, and she calculated the value, and she made sure of its safekeeping. Krishna asked the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the cause of all causes, the Alpha and the Omega, the person on whom everything rests like pearls on a thread. Krishna asked for the job of washing the feet of all the incoming guests. That's what you do when people come for a long distance. They're not driving an air-conditioned car. They're walking or riding. They get overheated. And the quickest way to cool them down and relax them is to wash their feet. Krishna asked for that job. Therefore, Krishna is all renounced. No one more renounced than Krishna. These are the Das avatars, the different incarnations of Krishna that appear throughout time and space. And we'll just go back. You'll go from the upper left is Matsya, the fish incarnation. Then you have the tortoise incarnation. You have the boar incarnation. You have the lion incarnation. You have Vamanadeva, the dwarf incarnation. You have Parasaram wielding the axe. You have Sri Ram. Ram is on your right on the altar. And above Ram you have Balaram, the brother of Krishna, then you have Buddha, and then you have Kalki. Those are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. How come Krishna's not there? I learned in school that Krishna's one of the 10 incarnations of Vishnu. Wrong. Jayadev Goswami in his Gita Govinda does not list Krishna as one of the 10 incarnations of Vishnu. And what are the reasons he gives? Krishna cannot be one of the 10 incarnations of Vishnu because all the Vishnus come from Krishna and not the other way around. So Krishna is not an incarnation of Vishnu. He's not one of the Das avatars. He is, as it says here by Vyasadeva, the compiler of the Vedic literature, Ete Kanksha Kalo Pumsham Krishna Stu Bhagavan Shayam. That Krishna who killed Kamsa, who was the foster child of Mother Yashoda, who was Giridhari, the lifter of Govardhan Hill, he is Shayam Bhagavan, the original form of Godhead from which all the other forms come. And he's a person laying to rest the question of whether the highest aspect of God is personal or impersonal. In the 14th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, I am the basis. Pratishtaham, that word pratishtaham means it's situated on. This laptop is pratishtaham. It's situated on this table. This table is pratishtaham. It's situated on this floor. This building is pratishtaham. It's situated on the earth. So Krishna says, yes, there is an impersonal aspect, but it is pratishtaham. It is based on me. I am not based on it, but it is coming from me. I am the source of the impersonal aspect. As we mentioned before, Krishna's body is transcendental, and only fools will deride him when he descends in the human form because they don't know his transcendental nature as the Supreme Lord of all that be. One who does know, however, the transcendental nature of Krishna's appearance and activities does not, upon leaving this body, take his birth again in the material world, but attains my eternal abode, O Krishna. So if Krishna is mundane, or if Krishna is impersonal, how is the claim made in the Bhagavad Gita that by knowing, in truth, the nature of Krishna's birth and activities, you get liberation? If Krishna, if the form of Krishna is material, if Krishna is a conditioned soul subject to birth, death, disease, and old age, how is it that by studying Krishna, you're never going to take birth again? Unless, in fact, he is transcendental. And then we'll conclude here by clarifying Krishna's relationship to the demigods. In Utah Valley, if you have LDS philosophy, there's a saying, as man is, God was, as God is, man will become. You can't become God. I hope that's not news to you, and I hope you're not terribly disappointed about that. because God means one, and as we've discussed, no two people could be on the level of Krishna. You could be godly, you could be godlike by serving God, by thinking righteous things, by doing God's service. You can become godlike or godly. You'll never become God, however. You could become, and the word for it in Vedas is demigod. It's a nice word. It's very specific. It refers to one who's not exactly mortal and at the same time not divine. And what is Krishna's relationship with the demigods? He says in the Gita, 10th chapter, 22nd verse, neither the host of demigods nor the great sages know my origin or opulences, for in every respect I am the source of the demigods and the sages. In charge of the various necessities of life, the demigods, being satisfied by the performance of sacrifice, will supply all necessities to you, but he who enjoys such gifts without offering them to the demigods in return is certainly a thief. So just like you pay your water bill, you pay your electrical bill, and then you ensure a continued supply from the head of the water department, from the head of the electrical department. So similarly, sacrifice is a system which is recommended for continued abundance of electricity, water, sunlight, and so on and so forth. If you just take these gifts, which are coming to us originally from God and through the demigod, if you just take them for granted and you don't offer anything back in sacrifice, then the supply will be restricted and there will be scarcity. Difference between the demigods and God, why you can't be God, and there's quite a long list here. I'll just go through them very quickly. Demigods are many, God is one. Demigods are part and parcel, God is the supreme whole. Demigods always worship the supreme as obedient servants, and Krishna is the worshipable supreme object of their worship. The demigods are created by Krishna. Krishna is the supreme creator. The demigods exist within the material world. Even though many of the demigods live for hundreds of thousands of years, they also die. Krishna is beyond the material creation. Demigods are delegated with various grades of power to manage the affairs of the material creation, but Krishna is ultimately the power behind those powers. Demigods are subordinate to the will of the Lord, and the Lord is not subordinate to anybody's will. He's simply really independent. Demigods have material bodies. Their bodies are not gross material bodies like ours. They're much finer, they're much longer lived, but they are material nevertheless. Whereas Krishna has a completely spiritual body which undergoes no birth, no old age, no disease, and no death. Demigods come under the influence of the modes of material nature. Krishna does not. The posts of demigods are temporary, where Krishna is eternally the Supreme Lord. Those who worship the demigods are considered less intelligent because by worshiping the demigods, they're only going to get a temporary benefit. Whereas by using the same amount of energy to worship Krishna, you're going to get an eternal benefit. Even if you approach, if you have a material desire, you can also worship Krishna in the fulfillment of that material desire. Because in the course of worshiping Krishna, one will get so purified that eventually that material desire will lose meaning for the devotee. The demigods cannot award benedictions unless they get the sanction of the Lord. Whereas all benedictions are ultimately awarded by Him alone. He says in the Bhagavad Gita that if one wants to worship a particular demigod, Krishna gives him the faith by which he can worship the demigod, but the result, the benediction, is actuality bestowed by Krishna alone. So the demigods are agents and Krishna is the supplier. The destination of those who worship the demigods go to the planets of the demigods, which are also annihilated in due course of time. But those who worship Krishna go to the spiritual world, which is never annihilated. Here it says, that which the Vedantists described as unmanifest and infallible, that which is known as the supreme destination, that place from which, having attained it, one never returns, that is my supreme abode. To worship the demigods is described as abhidhi purvakam in the Bhagavad Gita. It's improper. It's like if a policeman pulls you over for speeding, he gives you a ticket. The proper way is to pay that ticket to the government. If you want to short circuit that system and try to bribe the policeman, that's improper. You have to pay to the government. So worship of the demigods is an effort to short circuit the system that ultimately everything comes from Krishna. And then many demons worship demigods. They don't want to worship Krishna because Krishna is going to give you what's good for you. Demigods will often give you what you ask for. But Krishna will actually consider what's best for you and He may not give you what you ask for. He may give you something that you didn't ask for because it's going to be better than you. You may go to the physician with a disease and say, "Doctor, I'm really sick but I want to keep eating chocolate." The doctor, if he's got your best interest at heart, he'll not flatter you. He'll say, "You have to choose. You're eating too much chocolate, that's why you're sick. You cannot get well and eat chocolate. You have to stop eating chocolate." So all too often we go to God and we pray for things which are going to make us spiritually sick. Now if we go to demigod, they'll give it to us. But if we go to God, He will not give us what we ask for. He'll give us what's good for us. That's why demons, they don't like to worship Krishna. They like to worship the demigods because they're very willful and impetuous and obstinate. And ultimately, benediction cannot be awarded by the demigods. Demigods have to die, so if you want immortality, you can't get it from a demigod. You have to get it from that person who is himself immortal. Yeah. And by worshiping the demigods and getting your material lusts facilitated, those lusts are further invigorated. If you are approaching a fire and you have liquid, you say, "Well, here's a fire and here's liquid. I'll use the liquid to put the fire out." But the liquid is petroleum. You're going to get the opposite result. Not only will the fire not go out, it'll burn twice as brightly. So when the demigods facilitate the fulfillment of one's material desires, those material desires are never satisfied. They simply blaze up more and more brightly afterward. But even if one approaches Krishna with material desires, those desires will be purified. So just winding up here, the difference between God and the living entities and why we can never be God, we're constitutionally parts and parcels. We're not constitutionally the whole. He is constitutionally the whole. We are many, He's one, we're subordinate controllers. He's the supreme controller, we're dependent upon the Lord, and He's supremely independent. These are the three: Mahesh, Lord Shiva, Vishnu, and Brahma. And then so many other. You can get very, very confused. Even Hindus, sometimes they come to me. I've had Hindus come to me and say, I can't stand it anymore. I lie awake at night, you know. I can't. There's so many gods. How in the world am I going to satisfy all of them? It's like, I said, you're not. And you're not meant to either. Water the root. Don't water each leaf and flower and twig. Just put water in the root of the tree. You can never. There's 33 million demigods. How are you going to satisfy each and every one of them? There's no way. But if you water the root of the tree, then the demigods are automatically satisfied. So this is Krishna's universal form as revealed in the 10th chapter. And Krishna shows Arjuna in the course of imparting the Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna asks for a graphic demonstration of Krishna's all potency, and Krishna reveals to Arjuna his material form. It's a frightening form, and Arjuna does not relish it. Shortly thereafter, he asks Krishna, please revert to your original two-handed form, which is not as ferocious and intimidating, which Krishna then does. He reverts to his two-handed form. But we've got the point that Krishna is the source of all the demigods, all the planets, all the spiritual and material worlds. This is a little discourse on his various expansions. And I'll just finish here by flipping through. Krishna was on the planet 125 years. And we have some slides of his pastimes from birth through childhood. All of them wonderful. All of them supernatural. All of them befitting none other than the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and all of them relishable by great, great liberated souls. None of these activities are mundane. These are the activities, by studying, you achieve freedom from samsara, freedom from repeated birth and death. If you want to achieve that same freedom by meditating on something impersonal, it's very, very difficult. It's very unnatural to void your mind, to repress your senses, and to do nothing. The wonderful alternative is to read the Krishna book, which is downstairs in our gift store, learn about the pastimes of the Lord, relish them in this life and in the next life, go back to home, back to that transcendental abode where Krishna awaits you. Any questions? Yes.
Krishna being the supreme